case, criminal appeal, it's called State versus Valentine, and we're ready to proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jessica West. I am an assistant public defender in Douglas County, Nebraska, and I represent the appellant, Dejron Valentine. Mr. Valentine's vehicle was stopped for a suspected window tint violation, and at the conclusion of the stop, part of his vehicle had been disassembled, and he was booked on two felony counts, possession with intent to distribute marijuana, for which he was eventually acquitted and convicted of a lesser included infraction of just possession of marijuana less than an ounce, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. Appellant appeals on multiple grounds, and there are several reasons, each of them independent, that this court should reverse the decision of the lower court and either vacate the conviction of Mr. Valentine or remand with instruction for a new trial. These grounds are fivefold. First, the stop was improper because the officer could not provide an objective basis for his suspicion that the window tint was too dark. Second, the search was improper. It went well beyond the scope of reasonableness and was invalid under the Fourth Amendment. Third, there was an incorrect application of Section 28-1206 regarding who can possess a firearm and who is considered a prohibited person under Nebraska law during the year of 2017. Fourth, there were insufficient and prejudicial jury instructions provided. This is based on the jury instruction for possession with intent to distribute in comparison to the jury instruction for possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. And finally, there was insufficient evidence to convict. First, regarding the stop. To stop a vehicle for window tint violation, an objective basis must be given. The state has the burden of proof in a motion to suppress hearing. They have the burden to present to the court what that objective basis for the stop is. Officer Dempsey testified that it's his discretion in determining whether a window tint violation has occurred. He testified that maybe an objective basis is that he can't see someone inside the vehicle.
Isn't that reasonable given that the statute says that it's unlawful for a person to drive a motor vehicle and the ability to see into the motor vehicle is substantially impaired? And so if the tinting is dark enough to impair that view, isn't that sufficient for an officer to have a probable cause to stop?
The officer, that's not the evidence in this case, however. The officer said that that would be the objective basis. However, his testimony was that he could see inside the vehicle.
Wasn't that after
after the stop had been made, though?
No, it was during the stop. He was able to see that there was only one occupant in the vehicle, that that occupant did not make any furtive gestures, so he was able to see inside the vehicle.
While he was following him or after he was pulled over?
The line of questioning, again, was what was his basis, the line of questioning was whether he was able to see inside the vehicle, and he responded that he was able to tell that there was one occupant.
Do we need to know at what point?
I think that's a good question. However, again, the state has the burden of proof in that case, and that was not fleshed out. They have the responsibility to lay that objective groundwork, and they were not able to do that. And then on cross-examination, again, it was highlighted that Officer Dempsey operated under just his discretion, making that
a
hunch.
Did he testify to what his training and experience was with the tinted windows?
Not specific to the tinted windows, no. The appellee makes several arguments in this front. First, they argue that there does not need to be an objective basis, and they cite State v. Cook as a purported basis for this assertion. Of course, we know that this isn't the law. There does need to be an objective basis provided in order to stop a law. Good faith doctrine does not apply here. This is not a Leon search warrant issue. There does need to be an objective basis. And furthermore, as the court is very familiar, I believe Justice Reedman actually wrote the opinion in that case, and Justice Arterburn also sat in on the argument of that. The court upheld the stop in Cook not because of window tint violation, but because regarding the 911 caller providing reasonable suspicion to make that stop, there was also a turn signal violation justifying the stop in Cook. So that does not apply here in Valentine. Second, the state argues on page 14 of their brief that an objective basis was provider because Officer Dempsey testified he could see inside the vehicle. This goes to the line of questioning that you had earlier. However, this is an incomplete recitation of the record. It's acknowledged in the state's own statement of facts on page 6 and subsequent acknowledgement in the body of their argument on page 15. I'd also refer the court to the Bill of Exceptions, page 12, lines 22 through page 13, lines 20. It's improper and disingenuous for the appellee to argue this. Officer Dempsey stated that he was able to see that there was one occupant in the vehicle. And again, the burden of proof rests on the state. There was also some reference regarding the windows being different between the side and the back of the vehicle. Just that's not reasonable objective basis because the law allows for a difference in the tint between the side and the back of the vehicles.
Wasn't there some testimony that the officer perceived them to all be the same tint, and that became problematic because the front windows can't be as dark as is permitted in the back windows?
That was, his testimony was that he could tell a difference between the side and the back of the vehicles. And again, the law allows for 20% in the front and the back and 35%.
Would you agree that if this court determines that the stop was lawful, that the subsequent search then, because of the smell of marijuana in your client's car, was reasonable?
No, I disagree with
that.
Okay. Let's get on to that. So it is an improper search. And I do want to make an important distinction here because appellant is arguing there is a nuance in the argument here. First, the question is whether after they found the marijuana, should the search should have ended there. And second, the argument is whether that passenger side door panel should have been removed. So
you agree there was a basis to search the car once he smelled the marijuana, though.
I do agree with that.
Okay. So your argument is the extent of the search.
Correct. After they located the marijuana in the center console, all probable cause to search the remainder of the vehicle extinguished.
How did they know that was the only place that marijuana would be found?
They didn't have probable cause to search anywhere else.
Why?
The important distinction is that they smelt the odor of burnt marijuana. There was one occupant in the vehicle, and so the probable cause is that marijuana would be located within the reach of the burnt marijuana would be located within the reach of the lone occupant of the vehicle. The state points to Watt as somehow making it so that the entire vehicle could be searched, including the trunk and the passenger side door panel. However, that is not what Watt establishes. There's the line of cases is that the appellee cites is Seckinger, Ruzicka, and Watt. So first, on Seckinger, the first sentence of the court's analysis there is that the defendant didn't challenge the scope of the search, so that actually is not instructive in the case, although Seckinger does cite to Daly, and where the trooper smelled the odor of marijuana coming from the pickup bed of the truck, and so that was where the search of the truck occurred. Watt is distinguishable because the state oversimplifies the facts of that case. What allowed the officers to further search the vehicle in Watt is they developed probable cause there. The development of probable cause is because they saw marijuana, and then as they pulled the defendant out, they noticed him secret away something in his sock. There was a key located in the sock incident to arrest. The defendant lied about secreting something in his sock. The defendant lied about what the key was used for. The key was for the trunk. So the officer developed that probable cause to extend the search to the trunk of the vehicle. It is very important that this court not allow the extension of the search to go to the passenger side door panel because there was no probable cause that any contraband would be found there.
Did your client tell them that there would be nothing found in the vehicle?
My client denied that he had smoked any marijuana.
He in fact said that somebody else had smoked marijuana in the vehicle, but obviously that person was never there. So he denied there being any presence of marijuana at that time. Is that correct?
That is, the He denied that he smoked marijuana.
All right. So how is that different? Just reading your passage from the Watts case where it says it is just as logical to conclude that the finding of the small amount of marijuana in the passenger compartment after being told by the defendant that none existed simply served to substantiate the officer's suspicions and furnish additional probable cause to make a complete search of the automobile. How is this case any different than that?
May I respond?
You may.
The difference here is that the officer developed probable cause in the Watts case. There was no further evidence, statements, or indication that there would be more contraband found inside the vehicle.
That's not what the court said, though.
Watts specifically found that the conduct of the defendant, of Watt, secreting away the key and lying about the key is what allowed the officer to search the trunk of the vehicle. And again, that distinction of searching the passenger side door here is what is really critical. We cannot emphasize the importance of extending that search to the disassembly of a vehicle that opens the door to a very slippery slope of where does it end? Disassembling the vehicle entirely on the side of the roadway, taking off the steering column, removing and disassembling the engine.
How much effort did it take to, in your words, disassemble the door panel?
That is not relevant for what that opens the door to do. How much time it takes does not matter. We'd ask the court to reverse and vacate the decision of the lower court.
Thank you very much. Did you have a question? How much time did we take, counsel, over?
1:35.
Please add that to Appley's time if he wishes it. Mr. West?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Good afternoon, Ms. West. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appley of the State of Nebraska. If time permits, I'll briefly address all three of the appellant's overarching claims. As far as the first claim regarding the denial of the motion to suppress, the two issues before this court are the validity of the traffic stop and the validity of the subsequent search. We maintain that both were lawful, so the motion to suppress was properly denied. As far as the traffic stop, we maintain that it was lawful because there was reasonable suspicion to believe that the tint on Valentine's vehicle was too dark in violation of state law. Under Section 60-6257, there are several restrictions and regulations regarding tint on a motor vehicle. Among other things, it provides that it's unlawful to have tint that substantially impairs the ability to see into a vehicle, that would provide less than 35% transparency on the rear windows or less than 20% transparency on the front windows. I think I transposed that. I think it's 35% on the front window and 20% on the back. But,
does the record indicate at what point the officer could tell that there was just one person in the vehicle?
I don't recall if the record is clear on that. As far as this conflict on whether or not he could see into the vehicle, I mean, he very clearly indicated during the suppression hearing that he couldn't. Then I think it was six questions later, he was asked, now based on the tint level in this vehicle, were you able to see if there was more than one occupant? And he said yes. And I guess the question seemed a bit odd, and I'm not entirely sure what he meant by that or if he even understood the question. It certainly seemed out of place given that he had just testified that he couldn't see into the vehicle. It's hard to imagine he, six questions later, would say, oh, yeah, absolutely, I could. As I noted in my brief as well, at the second suppression hearing, that issue came up again, and he said he had no recollection of being able to see into the car.
Yes, this was at 10:30 at night, roughly,
yes,
that he was behind the vehicle, the defendant's vehicle, and was able to determine the tinting level of the glass.
Well, he wasn't able to determine the exact tint. His basis for the stop was that all the windows appeared to have the same tint, and the fact that he had difficulty seeing into the vehicle. He certainly wouldn't be required to establish the actual tint level just upon viewing a vehicle. I mean, that would be impossible as far as I know.
Was there any testimony with regard to cars with appropriate amount of tinting, that it's pretty easy to see into a car even at 10:30 at night to see how many passengers are in a car? Did he testify to that effect at all?
He did testify that when the tint level is appropriate on a vehicle that you can typically see inside a vehicle to some extent. I think he said he could almost see somebody, but generally speaking, you could see into the vehicle.
Even late at night?
I don't recall if he was clarified, if he was asked to clarify on that, but he certainly didn't indicate otherwise. I mean, that was the time in which this was occurring, and that was his testimony, and the trial court accepted his testimony. I don't think it's been shown that that was a clearly erroneous finding. So we would submit that the stop was lawful in this case for any of those bases under 60-6257. Just briefly, as far as Cook, I mean, the case isn't published anyway, so I'm not citing it for precedential purposes, but for what it's worth, this court's analysis did in fact find that that was a basis for the stop in that case. It noted that part of the basis for the stop was the fact that the officer testified the windows were too dark and that he made a left-hand turn and pull off to the side of the road without using his turn signal. Quote, both of these constituted independent traffic violations. Again, just cited for persuasive purposes, nothing more, but it is on point. Moving to the subsequent search of Valentine's vehicle, we maintain that it was justified and lawful based on the smell of marijuana, which of course provides probable cause to search a vehicle. We disagree with Valentine's assertion that the search had to cease once the officers found the two baggies of marijuana in the center console. We're aware of no authority that would support that assertion.
They could search the whole car, including the trunk.
Anywhere the contraband might reasonably be found. I mean, if you believe you're looking, you know, perhaps if you think you're searching for human trafficking, maybe you aren't going to be allowed to search in the glove box. But if you're searching for something like marijuana, sure, anywhere it can be found.
What about pulling up the side of the door that came apart or revealed the gun?
Well, if a person can conceal a firearm in the side of a door, I don't see why they couldn't conceal marijuana. That seems perfectly reasonable to me, that if you have probable cause to search for marijuana and anywhere in that vehicle in which it might be found, that a door panel or anywhere that could harbor marijuana would be fair game. We see no issue with the validity of the search. We would submit that it was lawful. I'll move on to the due process claim. The issue here is whether Valentine was charged with and convicted of the appropriate version of that statute, the possession of a firearm by a prohibited person statute. More specifically, the issue is whether the statute, in effect, required the state to prove all three of those things: A, that he had previously been convicted of a felony; B, that he was a fugitive from justice; and C, that he had violated a domestic abuse or sexual assault protection order. In other words, did the state have to prove all three or just one of these conditions? As set forth in our brief, we maintain that the state only had to prove one of the conditions. The statute, in effect, of course, didn't directly spell this out since it didn't include the or the and at that time, but we would submit that the most logical reading of the statute, coupled with the legislative history, would show that reflect that the legislature clearly intended it to be an or. So we maintain that he was charged with and convicted of the correct version of the statute. Just briefly on the last final claim regarding the validity of the jury instructions, the issue is whether the jury was properly instructed on the elements of possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. We maintain that the jury was properly instructed given that the trial court's instructions directly track the language of the statute and comport with NJI as well as our case law. We disagree with the appellant's assertion that the trial court's instruction should have required the jury to find that he knowingly and intentionally possessed a firearm. The statute governing the offense imposes no such requirements, and we submit that it would have been improper to add that to the elements instruction. We also disagree with the appellant's assertion that the trial court gave an incorrect definition of possession. Excuse me. As set forth in our brief, the trial court's definition of possession was consistent with NJI, as well as this court's recent decision in State v. Castellanos. So we submit that that portion of the instruction was correct as well.
His requested instruction for that jury instruction number 9 wasn't that different from what was offered, other than it added proximity, standing alone, is insufficient to prove possession. Would that have been an incorrect statement?
No, that's not an incorrect statement, and that is, it's been approved and is sometimes used in constructive possession cases. We're not taking the position that that's an incorrect statement, just that it wasn't necessary here and that the instructions given adequately supported the issues and adequately instructed the jury. Just as in Castellanos, the exact same issue came up and they proposed the same instruction, and this court concluded that while it might be a sufficient and correct statement of the law, it wasn't necessary here and you can't show you were prejudiced by not getting it. In some other circumstance where, you know, maybe you're at a house party, there's a whole group of people and a gun is found somewhere, and, you know, the facts are a little bit different. All of a sudden, maybe, you know, I think an instruction like that might be advisable. I think if I were a trial judge,
but
I might be
when you're the only person in the car.
Right, exactly, yeah. Right. I just don't think it really had any place here. Certainly, they can't show their prejudice, which would be their burden to show in order to obtain relief.
Going back to the search, let me ask you a couple of questions. Were there, first of all, I asked this question, Ms. West, and I'd like to ask you the same question. Was there any evidence with regard to the officer's training and experience with regard to the window tinting?
There was testimony about him being familiar with it, and I mean, I can't recall the exact testimony about the training, but I mean, I know he went into you know, the equipment they use, that they carry these devices to measure tint. They're trained to use and calibrate them. You know, the evidence established his didn't work, so we had to get someone else to bring a new one in, and he ultimately measured the tint on Mr. Valentine's vehicle, and which confirmed that it was, in fact, in violation of the law. The trial court found that he was trained, or at least, I can't remember the trial court's language of its order, that he was had experience with tint, I believe was the trial court's finding, and I think that's supported by the evidence.
And then what about with respect to searching the inside the door panel, was there any testimony from the officer regarding training and experience as to why he would choose to do that?
If I recall correctly, he testified that contraband is often concealed in those panels, and that's why he went and searched it. And I think if I remember certainly correctly, he did that almost immediately as he started searching the car, which would confirm the fact that.
All right. There was also some evidence, as I recall, that indicated that at some point there was information provided by other officers once they knew who was stopped about prior information with regard to Mr. Valentine. Do you recall where in the process the searching officer became aware of that?
I don't recall exactly. I recall that information did come about, but I don't recall the exact timeline of it.
Didn't he testify it was sometime after he had already initiated the stop that he became aware? It wasn't until after he initiated the stop.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. But as far as during the stop, after it had been initiated, I don't recall exactly.
There was no evidence that he knew who he was stopping.
No, I don't believe
right.
so. No.
Okay. Yeah. No. All right.
And you would agree that had the officer not smelled the marijuana emanating from the car when he was talking with the defendant, he would not have had a basis to engage in any further search of the vehicle.
No,
but for smelling the marijuana, that was sufficient.
The marijuana was sufficient, but I don't think there was anything else present here that would have warranted a search of that vehicle. No. We would submit that all the felon's claims are without merit, and if there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
I don't believe we have any rebuttal time, so thank you both very much for appearing here today, and the matter is submitted.